Welcome to Elite Achievement, a podcast for financial advisors and leaders in financial services who are building and scaling firms. I'm Kristen Burke. Let's start here. Building and scaling a firm requires more than strategy and execution. It also requires resilience. There will be moments of uncertainty, disappointment, pressure, and adversity that challenge how you think, respond, and continue pursuing your vision. In today's conversation, John O'Leary shares powerful lessons on mindset and resilience through one of the most extraordinary stories I've ever heard. Today's guest is someone who has inspired millions of people around the world. When John O'Leary was 9 years old, he survived a devastating accident that doctors believed he would not survive. Today, he's a best-selling author and one of the most sought-after speakers on resilience, hope, and purpose. His story has now been brought to life on the screen in the feature film Soul on Fire. John, I'm really grateful you're joining us today.
KB, it is good to be with you, my friend. I'm on the inner circle now, and I'm honored to be not only on your program, but with your people. So this is awesome.
Well, I'm happy to have you in the inner circle. So, John, let's go back. Many people know you today as a speaker and author, but your story begins with an accident that changed your life as a child. For listeners hearing it for the first time, can you take us back to that moment and how it shaped the person you became?
For sure. And I'll just even start even more recent than that. Like, I'm a dad. You know, like, that's probably my favorite job title. I have four kids. I'm married to Beth. I'm the son of two phenomenal people. I'm brothers to five amazing siblings and had four grandparents. Strong believer in my faith. Proud American. Not perfect, but I love where I live and get to raise my kids and try to make it better for the next generations and better for the world. And so there's all these job titles that I would put in front of speaking and writing and all the other things. So just for our listeners, like, I'm a guy, man, and I'm honored that somehow the story we're going to unpack today is impacting lives. It humbles me. So the question you asked, though, when I was a 9-year-old kid, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. And I saw boys in my neighborhood playing with fire and gasoline. I just assumed if these kids could do it, I could as well. So with my father at work on a Saturday morning and my mother out with a couple of my sisters, I made my way into the garage and went over to a red can of gasoline. And the plan, Kristen, was just to pour a little bit of gasoline on top of a piece of paper that was aflame. Before the liquid came out, you know how the story goes. Before the liquid came out, the fumes grabbed the flame, pulled that gas, the flame into the can of gasoline, split metal in two and picked me up, launching me 20 feet against the far side of the garage. And the net result was I, at age 9, was burned on 100% of my body, 87% of the burns third degree. And in 2026, as you and I record this, that is a death sentence, 100% burn. And in 1987, it's hopelessness. So that's the beginning of this story that remarkably ends up triumphant.
Thank you for sharing that story with us. And John, I know the story. I've heard you speak before. I've read, your mom wrote a book, right? Yeah. I read your mom's book. And of course, I watched Soul on Fire. But hearing you say it live and in person, it just hits differently. It truly brings the magnitude of what you experienced to life. And that experience could have defined your life in a very limiting way, but instead it seems to have expanded your purpose. At what point did you begin to see your story not just as something you survived, but something that could serve others?
You know, I wish I had like a Damascus story of like St. Paul on the horse and thunder and lightning and I'm blind for a few days. And mine's not that. I spent 5.5 months in hospital and went through dozens and dozens of surgeries, lost my fingers to amputation, spent a couple of years in a wheelchair, and spent probably a couple of decades at a pity party. And I will say very loudly, I hope you don't need to be burned to have a seat at that table. I think many of us, when you read the headlines or you deal with your own health issues or your family struggles or financial woes, whatever it is, it's so easy just to wave a white flag and proclaim the question, why me? So I became expert at that question for a long time. And you asked about like a turning point. And for me, it was more like erosion. It was just slow wears on me to begin to slowly recognize the beauty of the reflection. I should have died. And so the very fact that I was alive should have been enough to say, thank you, God. And yet for me, it wasn't. It just, I didn't see it like that. When it became most clear to me, I guess what it was at age 28, I was working construction at the time. Living in St. Louis, where I know you like to party too. So I'm hanging out in St. Louis. I'm working construction. That was my job, which is a peculiar job for a man with no fingers. I mean, so like, what are you doing, O'Leary? I'm showing the world that I'm enough. The whole thing was trying to prove to people my value when I did not believe it myself, which is a fool's errand. And in a church service on a Sunday morning, I found myself in the back row with my arms crossed, kind of bored, not only by the message, but kind of bored by life. And the pastor was talking about the gift of talents and ultimately said, and for those of you who feel as if you've received no talent, and that's kind of how I felt. I wasn't rich. I wasn't known. I wasn't successful. I wasn't talented in my mind. I wasn't where I wanted to be relationally. And like anything that you wanted to track, that's not me. I'm inarticulate. I did poor in school. Like, what do you want to measure success on? I have none of it. So when he said, if for those of you who feel like you've got no talent, listen to me. And then he goes, your life is a precious, priceless gift. And with that gift, you've got one job. All you have to do is say yes to being used for good. So I'm not a smart man, Jenny. I think it's Forrest Gump says, but I wrote those words down that night. And the following day, I'm working construction. My phone rings. In the movie, it shows a car pull up, but in real life, it wasn't a car. It was a phone. And it was a little girl, not a mom. And the little girl said, Mr. John, will you speak at my school? And, in any other day leading up to this one, I would have said, no, man, I don't speak. And, I don't do that. That's not me. I don't like my scars. But the day before, a leader had told me that my life was a precious, priceless gift and that I had one job. And it's e as easy as saying yes to being used for good. So I said yes, hung up the phone. 2 weeks later, walked into this room. In the movie, they had me speaking in front of like eight Girl Scouts. In real life, it was three. Hollywood lies. So I'm speaking to three Girl Scouts, do a pathetic job. But on the walk back, one of the room moms pulls me aside and says, that was awesome. Would you speak at my Rotary Club? And Kristen, I had no roadmap, no game plan, no success strategy, no 5-year vision, but I knew how to say yes. And the cool thing about the reps is the more you do them, the easier it gets. So I said yes to this Rotarian. In that room, there was a lady who crossed over into Kiwanis. She asked me, I said, yeah. In that room, there was someone from Chamber of Commerce. In that room, there was a woman who ran a prison system. And so this awkward, introverted nobody with no talent, just humbly and faithfully, and audaciously. I mean, you got to give yourself some credit. Just kept saying, yeah, I'll do that. And it has led now to, you mentioned in the forward, speaking to millions of people around the world. Ultimately, though, not about a fire story. I think when people book John O'Leary, they think like, tell us the story of the fire. And instead, it's a story of hope and restoration and community and faith and people coming together around a challenge and fighting for something bigger than themselves. That's the story. And that's one I think we can all rally around.
Absolutely. I appreciate how you point out saying yes. That's how I started my coaching business. I never sought out to become a coach and a consultant, but I had one financial advisor who actually moved offices, and he called me one day and said, I want you to coach me. Very similar. I said, no, I don't do that, right? How you would have answered prior to that day. No, I don't do that. What are you talking about? So we hung up, and maybe it was 6 months later, he called again. I thought, okay, well, maybe I should take this a bit more seriously. And, we set up a meeting, and like you, I had no roadmap, I had no game plan, I had no 5-year vision. I mean, I sent my first proposals out using PowerPoint. I didn't know what I was doing, but kept saying yes.
Awesome. And look where it's led.
Right? Now it's led
I
to me
mean,
talking to you.
what? And it leads to you speaking to others and motivating and moving them and equipping them to take the next right step forward in their journey. It's we so overcomplicate it. And it is as simple and as hard, because it is hard, as the audacity to say, I'll take the call. I'll try. I'll serve. I'll send you the PowerPoint. I'll go in front of the Rotarians. I'll do it for free. I'll do it when no one's watching, because none of this work is celebrated when we're doing it at first. In fact, if we're honest, it's probably mocked. And if you keep doing it and you do it well and your intention is to lift up others, it becomes unstoppable.
Absolutely. You mentioned you were trying to prove your value when you didn't believe it yourself. And I know a lot of leaders listen to this podcast, and I know that as you're growing a business and you're growing a team, it can be very difficult to feel that you're qualified to do that work, and you often aren't believing in yourself. How did you start believing in yourself to build what you have built?
Yeah, step by step. My wife and I frequently talk about, my gosh, I mean, it was so hard for so long, and it really was. Like there were 3 years where we essentially went without a paycheck. And so now people come into the office and they take the walk around and look at the artwork and the pictures of John in front of big audiences and books framed on the wall, like all this stuff that seems like, wow, what a success story. And I'm not sure that's what any of that stuff represents. I think it represents faithfully shutting your eyes and saying, I believe, and I'll go, and I'll just keep serving. And so it is a servant story. And when it became ultimately around me recognizing intrinsic value, though, was not when a picture of a book was framed and put up on a wall. For me, it's more like the individual conversations afterwards. It's a group of four Girl Scouts coming up afterwards and giving me a hug. That was pretty good. And then it's a few Rotarians saying, hey man, we get a lot of guys in here who have chicken salad with us at, on Tuesdays at noon, but there's something about your story. And then one of them might say, John, it's nothing like your story at all, but I've never told anybody this. And yet when I was 11, I went through some abuse. And then you're like, wow. And then you leave and you go to the next session and you're told about another story of impact. And over time, if you pay attention, you recognize there's something in your work and in your presence that gives people hope to move forward in their journey. And so over the last 20 years that we've been doing this, when you hear enough stories of impact, it begins to remind you not that you're all that, because I still don't feel like I've made it, not even at all, but that God is all of that, and that we have an opportunity daily to remind people that they can become more.
You mentioned you still don't feel like I've made it. Tell me more about that.
And what does that mean? I mean, is it money? Is that when you made it? Is it, well, what if you're hanging out with a guy with more money? Is it followers? What if when I'm having lunch with Brené Brown, like, well, she's got 10 times mine. So is she 10x better than me? What about when I'm hanging out with a little nun like I was last week, who's got no money and no followers, but she's actually impacting people profoundly? Is she somehow far bigger than I am, or I am bigger than she? Like, so making it, I don't know what that means. What I would say is, I was interviewed on a podcast years ago in New York, and walking out, this gentleman said, well, he's walking me out to the car. And as I look up, there's this big, beautiful, like, cement building with letters around the top. And I'm like, dude, what is that? And he said, it's the biggest synagogue in New York. I'm like, wow, what's that say? He said, it's Hebrew. And I said, I don't speak it, man. What's it say? And he said, I've been told that it's a quote from Micah. I'm like, well, what's the quote? And he said, the quote is, seek justice, love mercy, walk humbly with God. And when I look at my business these days and my big ambitious goals for 5 years out and 20 and multiplying, and man, my ambitious goal to make it now is to seek justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. And I do this in a very divided world where almost everybody who brings me to speak says, don't talk about politics, don't talk about faith. And yet, regardless of who brings me in, into what organization and what audience size, they ought to be aware that I'm seeking justice, I'm love and mercy, I'm walking humbly with God. I'm going to tell them how I got burned. I'm going to tell them how I recovered. I'm going to explain to them what it means for them. But at the end of the day, I'm not there for a paycheck. I'm not there for ego. I'm not there for followers or to sell books. We're there to remind people the dignity of their life and their agency to make their not only their individual life good and better, which is fine, that's called success, but far more importantly, to make their individual life bigger and better for others. And that's significance. And that's when your life takes on a whole new meaning. So when I talk about not making it, I recognize the blessing of my life. It's crazy. But I'm not there. When I will be there is when I can finally take my last breath and recognize that that Micah statement in Hebrew in New York finally applies to me.
How do you silence all the noise out there and stay true to your values, what's important to you, and what you're building?
I think what we pay attention to grows. I mean, you know this from your coaching work. So what you focus on expands, and your life will become more of that. And then you pull away from that for a moment, you go on social media. And not only do you see the same stories echoed, then you start seeing the echo chamber of your own beliefs that you already have. Then you start seeing the ladies who, unlike you, who are working today, they're on vacation with their feet in the sand. And they're showing you a different version of what your life should be. And their kids in the Christmas picture, and the way your life could have been. And it's all this comparative motto and mantra over things that I think are ultimately not healthy at all. The comparison we should strive for is to compare ourselves, who we are today, with who we were yesterday and who God is calling us to become tomorrow. And then boldly be audacious enough to shut your eyes and strive toward that. So the way I try to silence the voices, number one, because they are external frequently, is to not pay as much attention to them. I think you need gentle awareness. The front page of the Wall Street Journal ought to give you enough of it. I don't think you need to turn to page 10 or have the TV on in the background. I challenge your leaders, pay attention to how much time you spend listening to things that are utterly out of your control. So start with the external. That will give you a lot of freedom and flexibility back to live into your values. Secondly, have you spent time identifying what your values are? Have you been intentional on how you're going to start your day? What I find with many leaders is they wake up because they have to, because kids got to go to school and we got to pack the lunch and got to get the dog, all the stuff we have to do. I encourage the leaders I serve to get up an hour before you want to. And that's where you can do some fantastic work. It's where you can get in the word. It's where you can take a walk around the neighborhood when it's still dark. It's where you can keep your phone on airplane mode, on silent. It's where you can connect with who you are, with what really matters and what you're grateful for today. So you introduced me earlier as like a person who models resilience, which is flattering, but resilience is a muscle. Again, you don't need to be burned to become resilient. You just need to choose it. So the way to choose that, I think number one is faith. Secondly, it's gratitude. Third is a direction bigger than yourself. Like, what are you moving toward? What's the goal of that? Is it really just dollars? I know you work a lot of the insurance and financial planning world, assets under management, life insurance policies, EUM, like maybe, but I would track the numbers that matter most. And in tracking those numbers, the other numbers that used to matter a lot will begin to grow in ways you could never have fathomed.
As we talk about resilience, and you mentioned, John, resilience is a muscle. What does your experience teach leaders about how they should respond when life doesn't go as planned?
I would suggest to you life never goes as planned. And if you think you're following someone, or even at today on this conversation, having someone on who's got their life in order, that's not true. My marriage is hard. I love it, but it is not easy. My dad recently passed away. I struggle with grief. Did I do enough? He had 33 years of Parkinson's. Should I have been more proactive? Did I do enough during the 3+ decades? Was I there for him, his wife, his caretaker? My mom came in today and had lunch with me, but am I the son she should? Like all these questions of doubt. And that's with the first three relationships. What about my kid in college? Did I raise him the right way? Is his value system intact? Does he know what matters, why he's here? Is he doing the right thing? My other three kids, and on and on, and like all the things. So you can play that game for so long. I would try to remind people of this. When I was a little boy, going back to school the night before I went back to school, I did not want to go. I was never strong academically, but in particular, after being out of school for 18 months, like this was going to be hard. I was in a wheelchair at the time. I wasn't sure how I was going to take notes or open up my book bag or eat my, peanut butter and jelly. So I kept asking my dad, why me? And I wasn't just saying, Dad, why do I have to go to school? It was way deeper than that. Dad, why me? Why me? Why me? And my father, who is and was a phenomenal servant and leader, and you would have loved him, he finally stood up, he shut the bedroom door, came back over to me. He knelt in front of me, put his hands on my legs, like looked me square in the eyes. I'm 10 years old, and he goes, John, dang it. Why not you? Why not you? The terrible thing has happened. And then he said, and if you want to be a victim to it for the rest of your life, have at it. No one's going to blame you, man. You've been through the worst. Fire on 100% of your body, stuck in this wheelchair. You've been through the worst. He said, or like he got like this little glimmer in his eye, bright blue eyes. He goes, or you can choose to be a victor. And every room we roll you into, or God willing, one day you walk into, people will look up in awe and admiration of what you've overcome and what you're doing in your life. And then my father goes, John, victim or victor, your choice, not mine. He leaned forward, he kissed me, stood up, and walked out. I'm 10. Now I'm 48. 38 years later, that conversation still rings true and still challenges me daily. Because the fight is not just when you get burned or get the diagnosis or the markets turn south. The fight is every single time you look in the mirror, or you hear the limiting belief voices, or you hear the whisper of criticism coming from an internal person or externally. And what do you do with that? And what I do with it, and what I encourage your listeners to consider doing, is to ask the question, why me? But stop asking it like I did for a long time. Ask it like my dad challenges all of us to do it, as a victor. And in every room we walk into, people will look up in awe and admiration at what we have overcome and how we live our lives. And that's the big game. To ignore the, not to ignore the headlines, to not become the headlines. There's so many folks who served me so well in my story. Rather than reading about a child who got burned and saying hashtag thoughts and prayers, or where's God in this mess? Hashtag mess, you know? They went to work. I think the best among us, when they hear about the stories, rather than saying the world's on fire, it's a shame, they recognize there's a little part of the world that's on fire that they can help redeem. And so I try to live, and my wife tries to live, and we try to raise kids who are living where you see a problem, make a difference. Where you see trash, pick it up. Where you see injustice, reform it. But don't live in the misery that the marketplace likes to say you should be in. This is unpopular, but this is backed up with research. My friend Greg Easterbrook, who you should have on your podcast, wrote a book, something like "It's Never, It's Better Than It Looks." I'm an optimist through my heart. He's an optimist through his math. Whether you look at freedoms, longevity, justice, the ability to say what you want, whatever the thing is you want to measure is like an important thing, abject poverty, anything you want to measure globally, it's never been better. Which is like you will not hear this tonight, but I'm telling you right now, it has never been better. So where you see the crisis, rather than complaining and turning that into a louder signal, strive to make a difference. And as good as it is, let's together make it better.
Yeah. You talked about so many questions, and sometimes we all have doubt. You mentioned the story about where you see trash, pick it up. It reminds me, this past weekend we were at the beach, and our daughter picks up a red Solo cup and runs it over. She's like, "Mom, this was trash, and I picked it up." And so I thought, okay, that's one check mark that I'm doing something in the right direction, right?
Keep
We
going.
keep
But
going.
that one thing we do. Okay, but the backstory is years ago, I was speaking to a guy, a family, actually, a family of billionaires who ran a business. It was a family business. And yet they were so humble. Like they were like, "Can I please get you some more water?" I'm like, "You guys, like, no, sit in the front row. Like, let me get my own water." And they're like, "No, please." And they were just so beautiful. So I reached over to the mom later on, this stately woman. And I said, "How have you raised such great kids? You know, like, these were like 20-year-olds, and they could have been so obnoxious and about them, the billion-dollar estate plus." And she said, I can't think of anything I did." And I'm like, "Well, give me something, because I'm trying to raise better kids." And she said, "Well, one thing we did, we would have dinner together nightly as a family. And she said we would pray, but as we were talking, rather than just like kind of randomly talking, she said we would play a little game. And I'm like, well, what was the game? And she goes, it was a highlight, low light, one and one. I'm like, well, what's that? So the question around the dinner table, and now it's the question we use, and the one you've used with your daughter, apparently. Best part of your day? Celebrate it. Worst part of the day? Let us know what's really going on. It's like those two things break the wall down. Because then all day long, they recognize there's a safe place at the end of it to tell mom what's happening. So highlight, low light, which is awesome. And then one nice thing someone did for you. And one nice thing you, the Red Solo Cup, did for someone else. What happens then is all day long, my kids and the billionaire's kids, and now your daughter, are not only seeking evidence of people doing good for them in a marketplace that says that doesn't exist anymore, but they're also recognizing, because mom's going to ask this question at the dinner table and I better have something, they recognize, I guess I can help her with the homework. I guess I can hold the door open for the teacher coming in behind me. I guess I can pick up the Red Solo cup on the beach. So when mom asked me tonight, what did you do? Well, mom, remember? Remember when I was floating away and I went into the water and I got it, mom. And so if you're trying to raise a generation of people who are equipped to make the world better, I learned that little lesson from this incredible woman in North Dakota. And I've been trying to instill it in my kids. And Kristen, I think you've done an incredible job, apparently, instilling this in your daughter.
Thank you. Well, I think we definitely talk about the best part of your day, sometimes the worst part, but I need to add the one nice thing someone did for you and one nice thing you did for someone else. John, when I watched Soul on Fire, there was a moment that really moved me. Okay, if we're being honest, I cried a lot of the movies. There were a lot of moments that moved me, but this particular moment was when doctors had given you about a 1% chance to live, and your mom asked you a remarkable question. She asked whether you wanted to live or die, and your response was, "I want to live." That level of determination at such a young age, is extraordinary. What do you think allowed you to make that choice in that moment?
Well, you know me well enough to know that almost all my work is about everybody else. So when I tell stories like the one you're asking me about, my angle on this is, can you imagine being a mom with a dying child looking up for hope and encouragement and certainty? And then you respond to their question. Do you know, the question was, Mama, am I gonna die? I'm hopeless. I'm longing for like anything. Mom, give me something. And she looks back and says, do you want to? Like, that is so bold, leaders. I know everybody listening to your podcast, like, not only are they leading their reflection in the mirror, many are leading families, many are leading their aging parents, and many are leading organizations. Imagine when someone comes in and saying, I'm struggling with work. What should I do? Like, do you want to be here? Like, that's what she ultimately, it's not, you can't do it for them. They've got to choose it for themselves. My incredible mother recognizes there's no motivational speech she could deliver right now to give John fuel. He's got to choose it. So she said, do you want to? And I said, Mom, I don't want to die. I want to live. And her response was good. Take the hand of God, walk the journey with him, but you fight. Do your part, John. You fight like you never fought before. And Kristen, like, that was enough. When she told me, take the hand of God, walk the journey, mom and dad will be with me, but do your part and fight. I didn't need to know biology lessons of skin grafts or amputations or, debridement. I didn't need to know the blueprint forward to healing and ultimately restoration in life. I knew what my part was. I guess I'll fight. And that was enough. That was enough. And I think, we're so well researched these days, which is such a blessing. And I think to a degree, a curse. Because if that child had any clue how difficult the story forward would be, I think he may have made a different answer. Just be honest. John, in 2 months, they're going to amputate your fingers. John, they're going to take you through the daily bandage changes. It's going to be 3 hours in length. In the movie, they're going to show 7 seconds. But in real life, it's 3 hours daily. John, they'll take you into a closet about halfway through your treatment. It's going to be called physical therapy. But don't worry, they'll put a towel in your mouth so no one will hear your screams. And John, eventually, when you come out of the hospital, you'll still go back for 2 years. And John, after the end of the 2 years, you'll spend a lifetime with people staring at you. Would you do that? And I think so often now that we know the path forward, we because ChatGPT it, I will tell you exactly what the treatment schedule is, how unlikely it is for me to survive that mammogram, and if you do survive, what it's going to look like and lead you to. Or you can take the hand of God, walk the journey with Him, and you fight like you never fought before. And I think the wisdom for a child to do that, or in my case, as a 28-year-old, speak to Girl Scouts. I guess I'll do that. Rotary Club. I mean, shoot, I don't know. I'll do it. If you told me, John, in 25 years you'll have this, but it will require that effort, I don't know if I would have done it. But if I can take the next right step in the direction of a vision, man, I think all of us have the power to take the next step.
Absolutely. You've told your story now for many years and, many times. And has your understanding of it changed over time? Is there a lesson that you see today in your story that you didn't maybe when you were younger?
For sure. I mean, at first I had no confidence in me or the story. Then I had undeserved confidence in me, but not the story. And now I have confidence in the story and sometimes struggle with me. And if you're like, well, what's the story? And I think it's layered. And sometimes people are think they leave a session and they're like, wow, that was a I can't believe that baseball radio announcer came back and brought on baseball. And so like sometimes it's more superficial for them, which is fine. But if you really pay attention, it's the dignity and the ability for every life and every circumstance ultimately to be used for good. Like that's you go through the story and that's really what takes place. And even behind me, you're interviewing me with, you and I can see each other. Well, the movie poster of Soul on Fire is not a picture of John O'Leary. And like a victory shot on the front where you see his face, like a keynote with like his arm in the air, like I just killed it again. Hear me roar. It instead is a picture of the guy who plays me with his back toward the viewer. It's a silhouette. And if you like to zoom in a little bit, it's made up of 120 images of people from John and the movie's life, characters in that story who stepped forward, what they did. The leadership they modeled, the impact it had, and if you pay attention, what it means for others in your life. So what I have become super aware of now is that this story has nothing to do with me, which is the only way I can stomach doing podcasts or keynotes or writing books or making movies because I'm so done with the word I. Like I hate the word I, but when the word is about we, and what collective, and I'm not some socialist. I'm not moving us toward communism. I believe in conscious capitalism, candidly. I believe like you're called to become the best version of yourself in order to lift up those around you. That's the call. So our story now represents that in a way that I think very few other real stories do as clearly. Because when you get to know John, you're underwhelmed by him. When you get to hear the story of what he went through as a kid, you're overwhelmed that somehow this little boy survived it. When you hear how a little Midwest family, how did they do any of this? And then if you like go into the professional piece, like built a global speaking business and the movie, like none of it's possible unless you lean into your faith and you ask your neighbors for help. And you have the boldness to keep advancing toward your vision with humility, with a little bit of audacity. And you learn the lessons that you made mistakes on today and apply them tomorrow. So I think if you just keep kind of washing your hair in that manner, you make tomorrow slightly better than yesterday. You know from the financial world as a coach, compound interest is a real thing. And we show our clients that when we show them the perspectives of why we buy this and not that. And well, look at the hockey stick 24 years in. Like that, yeah, good. That's what money does. What does it do in relationships? What does it do in the way you refine the way you show up in public? The way you serve, the way you grow spiritually, the way you love your neighbor, the way you pour into your spouse, the way you fight through that addiction. How could that happen? Compound interest, day over day, week after week, month over month, if you keep doing the right thing over time. And in leadership development, that's one thing that we oftentimes sort of ignore because it's the ugly work of daily life, But that's ultimately where the real stuff takes place.
You know, one of the things I'm noticing a lot in leadership development is that leaders are very quick to step away from the fundamentals of what worked and what got them there. And I think some of it is because maybe they have other focuses, right, as they're leading others, or some of it might be that they maybe feel like they don't need to do that anymore. But I think what I'm hearing you say is that there is this ugly work that needs to happen. And when we keep doing it over and over, and that compound interest can really turn into something special.
And the way you get, if you're like, well, John, that's a good idea, I don't know how to do that, watch the movie Soul on Fire, and then be aware that the guy portrayed by William H. Macy, his name is Jack Buck, big old radio announcer. He asked the question nightly, what more can I do? And in asking that simple little question and then taking the next right step, it not only changed his trajectory as a Hall of Fame radio announcer and six other Hall of Fames to boot, it left a mark in society that was movie worthy. And I'm one of many of the stories that this man left behind. So although maybe none of us will become the next Jack Buck, when we ask that question, it gets you back to the fundamentals of doing the right work the right way, for the right reasons. And to me, I know we're here with leaders and it's like, John, what about growth? And what can I become by 2030? Like, great. And if you lose your family in the means, in the process of that, you wasted everything. And if you lose your health, you wasted everything. And if you lose your faith path, what's the point? So that question not only is tethered toward professional success, great. I sincerely, like, I love growth, but also it ensures that you lean your ladder against the right wall.
Yeah. Well, I think in our conversation today, John, you've asked us a lot of questions that we can all take and reflect on. You know, what more can I do instead of why me, why not me? And, you know, what was the best part of the day? What's the worst part of the day? And, you know, what's one thing I did for someone else? And what's one thing someone else did for me? And you had mentioned the power of reflection earlier in our conversation, and I bet if our listeners take those questions and apply them to their lives, it'll make a really big impact.
Or their team. Like, listen, I do this with my kids, and yet we also do it as a team. Mm-hmm. What we're chatting about here is not like, John, are you saying we need to do offsites? Like, maybe. I have no idea. That's for you to figure out. But I do know if you can look at a team member and say, what was the best part of your weekend, worst part? One nice thing. It just, first of all, humanizes the work. And secondly, we'll get them to focus on the main thing. So what we're talking about here is not only for us and our families, but for those we lead forward.
John, I appreciate you taking some time to connect with us today. If our listeners are curious to learn more about you, the work that you do, the movie Soul on Fire, where can they find you?
So if you go to johnolearyinspires.com, so J-O-H-N-O-L-E-A-R-Y, inspires.com, that's our primary website. We have links to our community, our movies and books. Ultimately, the work, man. Like, the work, what we do, if I'm being super honest, is like I try to use the megaphone of film, books, podcasts, and speeches to walk with individuals. All of our work is ultimately about bringing the big to the small and taking the complex to the simple. So we look forward to walking with you one-to-one at johnolearyinspires.com.
John, thanks so much for your time today.
KB, you're awesome. Good to be on the inner circle.
And to those of you listening, what are you taking away from today's conversation? I appreciate you listening and investing the time to grow as a leader. Follow Elite Achievement for more conversations on leadership and building a firm.